In order to even have the inner space to be a seeker or a mumukshu, you know, that requires a certain amount of shanti. We call it grace also. Ishwara Nugraha, that shanti, is called grace. Bhagavan's grace, to have that inner peace or that inner shanti. But that grace, when we use this anugraha, means grace, that grace is actually not random. Like Bhagavan says, well, I'll bless you and you, but not you or you. It's not a random grace. It's a grace that is born of dharma. So it's actually a karma pala, the result of a karma, what we call really, and we can call a manasa karma, a mental karma, a karma that's brought about by choice, by attitude. Like you can bless somebody or you can curse them also. And with your will or the way you use your mind or the way you approach people, it can be blessing them, caring about them, loving them, or it can be making their life miserable also, cursing them, wishing they were dead or whatever. Those are karmas, you know, and they affect you and they affect the other person also. Just look at your life. How some, being in the presence of some people energize you and make you feel warm, they make you feel loved and comfortable. You don't even necessarily have to think about it, it's just a fact. In their presence, you are relaxed and feel at home with yourself. And then in the presence of a different type of person, you can feel very uncomfortable, very kind of awkward. You can feel your self-worth can be quite deflated. And you can feel disliked, all of these types of things, which are very negative states of mind that are brought about by that interaction, that relationship. And so the way that we behave in the world, if we're looking at living a dharmic life, has to do with generating in ourselves and others that shanti, you know. And what's so interesting is that whatever we are generating in the other, we ourselves are experiencing. That sometimes we don't get that. That for me, when I finally understood that, that was a very helpful realization. That the affect that you're generating in the other is something that you are also enjoying. So if it's positive, if it's in a positive affect, you're enjoying that. But if it's a negative one, then you're experiencing that. So that's kind of an automatic, immediate type of retribution. You know, we kind of, what's that one? You sow, whatever, you reap what you sow. You know, that's kind of a truism. You reap what you sow. So that's in reference even to the external world. But we also reap what we sow in terms of our inner world. In fact, it's really helpful to realize that actually just like this so-called outer world, external to my body, so I have a subject-object relationship from the standpoint of the body to the object, this is what we call the outer world, the inner world is also outer from the standpoint of myself or from the standpoint of the buddhi, because I also have a relationship with that. You have a relationship with your unconscious. You have a relationship with your conscious mind, too. You know, you have a relationship with, say, for instance, you commit some mistake or you get angry or you do something that is embarrassing, you embarrass yourself in some way. How do you relate to that person who just made that mistake? That person's you, right? how do you relate to that person? Do you make that person feel better or feel worse? You know, because, I mean, that matters internally as much as externally. And so it's not just how I am toward the external world, it's how I am, period. How I am to all of my experience. It's even true how I am to my animals or how I am to plants or how I am to the earth or how I am to whatever experience I'm having. How am I? And so Dharma, at the pinnacle of Dharma is ahimsa, is let me not cause any injury. That's the overarching Dharma for all beings. Let me not, willfully in some way harm another person or another animal or another anything. Another grass. In India, they pray to the grass before they plow it, to thank the grass for growing and for feeding us, They do some chants and whatnot. So this Dharma, and I think in all of the religions of the world, all of these attitudes and ways of being in the world are taught by all the religions in the world, because they give that blessing. They give a blessing. And the blessing is that shanti that gives that kind of sacred inner space. And it's that sacred inner space. Say if we're trying to meditate or just be with myself or to have a prayerful life, I need that. I need to resolve into that inner space, into that sacred inner space that we call shanti. Okay. So understanding that Dharma in terms of our interpersonal and intrapersonal relationships is really important, because it repairs all childhood damage, which I'll be talking about in a minute. We repair the childhood damage. And just on a day-to-day basis, we have an abiding peace. And to whatever degree that we venture off from that, then we've created some pain for ourselves, and then we have to know how to go and heal that. So even if you're going to heal it in the past or heal it right now, in the moment, because some hurtful thing has happened, we need to understand it and what is necessary in order to bring that shanti back. Right? And that, I think for a seeker, that ability or strength or commitment to do that becomes primary. It's not primary that somebody did something wrong and we yelled at them so they got what they deserved. That's not primary, because when we take that type of an action, we're giving them what they deserve, which we're now also experiencing. And so once you kind of figure out these laws, you don't want to play in that arena, You want to be able to bring the whole situation back to an inner sense of well-being. That's not at all being a wimp or being weak. It is being objective, It was once Swamiji taught this, and I finally learned it. He's a master at this. Is that you can say to anyone, you can say no, I don't want to do that, or no, that won't work for me, or no, this isn't the way I want to go, or whatever. You can say no, or no, I don't really want to go out, I'm a homebody, I like to stay home. You can say no in all kinds of in about anything. You can make all of your boundaries in a nice way. People are fine with that. I've seen Swamiji has said no in so many ways. Nobody thinks, he's saying no. Nobody feels like they're being told no. Even though he doesn't want to do this or doesn't want to do that, it's not available for this or that. Nobody feels rejected. It's just not necessarily. You can nicely say no. It doesn't mean anything. You don't want to do something, people aren't going to say, oh my God. They don't respond in that way. But what happens is, because we don't have we are not skilled, or we don't understand about that it's easy to say no, and that it doesn't have to be a violent act. It's fine to not want to do something. We don't know that. And so what happens is we will avoid people, stay away from people, hedge around so that they don't ask you something, Because you don't know that you can nicely say no. So all of these are what we call kaushalam. They're all skills. When we talk about karma yoga, some is just ishvara, that Ishvara Arpana Buddhi, when I just see the whole universe as Ishvara as Bhagavan, and I take my life moment to moment to moment, and I do what there's to be done. Everything is just responding to Ishvara. The Kaushalam is having certain skills in how to handle myself and how to handle other people in a way that's not hurtful. You know, we have to learn some of these things. It'd be nice if we were really taught from childhood some of the things that are just skills to be learned, where everybody is fine and boundaries are set, and you know, it keeps shanti. It keeps a shanti in your own being, and when the shanti is there, that peace is there in your own being, then it's there in the people around you also, because there's nobody, you know, roughing up the waters. But it takes some practice and some skill and some consciousness in learning how to do that. You know. So what we're starting with when we're kind of learning how to develop these attitudes in ourselves, one good way is, well, first of all, to remember that however I'm treating other people, I'm treating myself in that way. Because whatever feelings I'm generating for you are taking place in me also. Like, say, if I hate you, you feel hated, but I feel hatred. You're feeling hated, and I'm feeling hated also in the form of hatred. So hatred is there, you know. If I dislike you, I'm feeling dislike. That's the emotion that I have.
Yeah.
You know, these are painful emotions. If I'm feeling love, that's the emotion that I have. If I'm feeling respect, that's the emotion that I have. So when you think of all of these emotions that you enjoy to have that are natural and make you feel strong and whole and healthy, then you just have to learn how to give those emotions. Yeah, you give that and you have that. It's not a phony thing. You can't. If you give a phony thing, then you feel that phony thing. That's what you get. You know. But I think it's a matter of consciousness, and what that consciousness does is give you a certain shanti. That then, in that shanti, the mind is available for contemplation. That's the whole point of this. The mind is available for contemplation. Otherwise, we are contemplating on that pain, right? So when you want to meditate, the first thing that's going to happen is if there's somebody that you hate or dislike, when you start to contemplate, that's the object of contemplation, because that's like a sore. It's what's drawing your mind. So we have to accept that. That's just a fact. And also, if we have taken care of some of these external things that happen to be in the present that are just going to draw you, contemplate, there's your mind right there in that hurtful space. We have also internally, inside, in our unconscious, little ones that there's hurts inside. And what those hurts inside are, again, they are usually in the form of a dyad. Like, say, for instance, something happened between me and somebody else, and there's a bad feeling there, so I want to just be with myself and contemplate, this thing has to be taken care of, because that's the sore in the room, right? That's external. Now, that's a dyad between me and somebody else. Dyad means it's a twosome, usually. I have those twosomes inside, you know, to this day. And I'm sure this is true for everyone. You may have, in childhood, maybe 2, 3, 5, 6, 10 different events that took place when you were little that are still vivid in your imagination along with the affect. You know, it's very interesting, you know. And so those are lying there in the unconscious, that dyad with the hurt, you know, or the shame or the emotion, they're lying there in the unconscious. waiting to be triggered by something that goes on out here. Somebody looks at you in a particular way, somebody says something in a particular way, and that little unconscious dyad that's just sitting there inside is triggered, and those feelings come out and are projected onto whatever is happening in the world. So they're stored. You have a lot of stuff stored in the unconscious. We don't usually know about that until we do, until somebody teaches you, or you go to a therapist or something, and you find out about all of these things, you know. But once you find out that there are dyads inside, this little inner child pains going on inside, then what happens is it's not only this external world that we're coming into relationship with, we start to come into relationship with that internal world in terms of the emotions and feelings that are generated in my psyche. For instance, say somebody looks at you in a certain way or says something to you, and you have some big emotion comes up inside. What Jung would say, it's a little bigger than really the situation warrants. The feeling is bigger than what the situation actually warrants. We don't usually even know to think like that. All we know is this person really hurt me. That's what we know. So it's all out here. But once you start to learn about this unconscious material and how the psyche works, when an emotion is generated inside, then instead of going out here and this person has hurt me and blah, 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 all the stuff, you first go inside to that emotion. And then you talk to that emotion and you say, what's this really about? Tell me what's wrong. And that emotion will talk to you because it is a dyad that had been interjected when you were too little to be able to handle it in any other way. You see what I mean? Little children don't know how to handle these big emotions. So they just suck it up and keep it in the unconscious. So my therapist, I was in Jungian analysis some years ago. One time he said, you know, you can't, if you are meditating or have a contemplative practice, you have to go through the little ones first. You can't just, here's all these hurt little ones inside in your unconscious and you're trying to contemplate. Well, you've taken care of these external things, everything's fine for the moment, so now you're trying to contemplate. And where are you landing? You're landing in this reservoir of pain, or if you don't get that far, you're landing in the most boring force field. If you ever had that experience, like you're going to meditate and it is, your mind is quiet, everything's really quiet and nice, and it's just one big so what, because there's no absorption at all. It's a quiet mind with no absorption. No ananda, it's just because there's a force field there. And that's an unconscious defense system. And so we have to be able to learn how to, as just a way of being, how to be with my unconscious as well as with this conscious world in order for the shanti that the mind is enjoying to go into the kind of the deeper psyche of the unconscious, where those little ones also have some shanti. Instead of being, have that pain swallowed inside, you know, and just waiting for somebody to come in and save them. So, so long as you realized all of this so, in so much depth, really, that he started doing inner child work type of contemplations. And he would do a lot of contemplations that involved also your relationship with your parents, you know, because your relationship with family members, relationships with your relationship with your partner, all of these, you know, familial relationships and partner relationships, are great triggers when you were little, they caused a lot of pain, you know, and then in the relationships that you have in the present, that childhood pain is generated by the closeness of the intimate relationship that you share. And so all of these variety of relationships become sadhana for us in order to resolve some of this stored pain. Because otherwise, if you don't know how to, if you're afraid of it, if you're afraid to have those feelings, you know, then you push them away. And when you push them away, there's no shanti, there's no acceptance, there's no resolution. And so we have to gain that skill of being able to say, okay, you can be with me. Whatever the feeling, it could be deep shame. We've all, especially as little kids, most of us have had very humiliating, shameful experiences. I mean, for an adult would look at it and say, what's so shameful about that? You know, but for a little child, it'd be very big, embarrassing, shameful experiences, and that shame is all internalized. Well, we don't want to experience shame. So it's a hard one to just sit there and feel shame. But now you have to be able to say, it's okay, you can be with me. I'm not afraid of those feelings. I can be afraid to feel fear. What if I had a lot of fear when I was little? I can be afraid, like, of course we're afraid of fear. Fear is fear. So we have fear of fear. But then you have to be brave and realize that it's just an emotion. And I can be with that. Then what happens is that shanti starts, because the shanti of the buddhi, the one that's accepting, that one has shanti, and it's allowing the fear or the shame or the guilt or the embarrassment or whatever the thing is, or the anger, you know, it allows that one to be welcomed into the shanti of your buddhi, and then it can transform and relax in that welcoming. Just think of a little child crying and crying and crying, being held by its mom or dad. The strength of the mother or father and the love of the mother and father allows that child to go through its trauma. It'll be fine and run off. But if there's no one there to be with it, to say, you know, you can be with me, I love you, you know, then they're trying to hold it by themselves. And there's a tremendous amount of stress and tension that takes place in the whole body and unconscious. So now we have to repair that, those hurts, because they repair that damage. It is damage. It's our bruises, you know. We have a lot of bruises that need to be repaired. You know, and so, but to repair them, you have to welcome them. You know, with welcome, I like the word welcome because it involves love. Yeah. That means we have to be willing to experience those things. And sometimes if we have some hard experiences, really hard experiences, like big betrayals and all kinds of horrid things that happen to some people in one way or another, sometimes you have to be able to just sit with and hold those emotions until they exhaust themselves. That means you've found a good parent that can hold the hurt emotion of the child. So this is, all of this is healing work, you know, so that my psyche enjoys some sort of relative wholeness. So that I've healed some of these wounds that go on hurting. Even for a jnani, if these wounds are there, they go on hurting unless I'm not afraid of them. If I welcome them and I'm not afraid of them, then just like if I'm with somebody who's hurt in the world or needs my attention in the world, I'm fine. I can also be very fine with whatever traumas are there inside, because I'm not afraid of them. I'm not pushing them away. That's the sannyasa vow. Abhayam. I love this vow. It's something that you can repeat and contemplate on every day. And what it is, Abhayam means freedom from fear. It means, let me not be afraid of any being. And then let no being be afraid of me. It's a tremendous sadhana. Because the only reason that I push anyone away or any part of myself away or reject any person is because I'm afraid of them. I'm afraid that in one way or another they have the power to disturb me or to take away my shanti or to take away my well-being. Just their presence in some way takes something away from me. You know, that, and so it's not where you can say, oh, I'm not afraid of anybody. I mean, I would be afraid if somebody was attacking me. And that's not really, probably not going to happen. Somebody's going to come and get me like a boogeyman or something. But no, and we're not talking about that. We have to deal with the boogeyman. Okay, say there's some, deal with that. That's a very objective, okay, let's see, what are we going to do with that? That's an objective thing. But every day, you're running up against more subtle fears. Subtle fears where someone you want to keep away from you because you're afraid of them. What are you afraid of? Is that in some way they take away your shanti, your sense of well-being. It can be the smallest little thing, but we have to become conscious of it, you know? So let no being be afraid of, let me not be afraid of any being, and let no being be afraid of me. That's the Abhayam vow of the sannyasi. Abhaya means fear. Abhaya means freedom of fear. So now if I say, let no being be afraid of, let me not be, we have to say this first, let me not be afraid of any being, and let no being be afraid of me. But if you're afraid of them, they will be afraid of you. Because you're rejecting them. And so, of course, they'll feel the rejected, and then they'll, it's kind of a vicious circle, then they'll be afraid of you because they don't want to experience rejection. You see, it's just kind of a vicious circle. You know, so it becomes sadhana, this whole idea of sadhana and contemplation, it's actually it's a commitment. It's a commitment to a value that you have a value for. That's why Swamiji wrote this book, Value of Values. You know, so say you want a contemplative mind, or you want to practice samadhi. These are huge words. I want to just meditate and practice samadhi. Okay. but honestly, these sadhanas that I'm talking about now, and kind of on the level of the unconscious now, these are what give the mind that natural shanti. And in that natural shanti, your being is predominant. Otherwise, your being is always, just like the clay is the self of the pot, right? It's never not going to be the self of the pot. The clay is really the only thing that's there. But the pot is so busy, you know, with so many things that it's distracting itself continually. But what if the pot has shanti? What if your mind has some shanti? Then it's not competing with its own self. And so as it relaxes and just is there and present with Ishvara, what is dominant is the reality of your being, which is absolute shanti. So we want to bring the mind into some relative shanti, so that mind is not generating so many affects that even though I am there in absolute shanti of my being, you know, I'm sharing the stage with a lot of painful affect that is brought about by some form of adharma. So when I say adharma is kind of a big scary word, but think of adharma as some form of himsa, of some where I'm creating pain for myself or another. And the tremendous sadhana or alertness or commitment that it takes on the part of a person to actually rein all of that in. You have to rein it in. But to rein it in, you know, it requires a value for the values, a depth of understanding. You know, because the mind is used to defending itself in one way or another. That's what I'm saying. So now what I want to do is just, we have time for a little meditation where we do a little bit of that inner child work. What you do with inner child work, we can do with adults, we can do with anything. There's many different kinds. I'll keep, even when we're doing the Katha Upanishad, I'll keep doing some of these things in the guided meditation we do before the class. But I just wanted to kind of give you what I hope is some depth of understanding of how important it is, actually. Because otherwise we're living in what we call that subjective reality of generated pain. It's called Pratibhasika. Pratibhasika is Jiva Srishti. Pratibhasika means the subjective. So we say Pratibhasika Satyam, the subjective reality, right? That subjective reality in what we also call that, which is the creation of the jiva. The jiva is that sense of self that is generated there out of self-ignorance. That's what makes the jiva. So the jiva's creation is all of this. So as you would say, gutta-butt, make up this word, this blah, all of the stuff that's coming out of our mind that has no basis in Ishwar Srishti. We're creating it and then responding to it. So we want to learn about that so that we can rein it in when it's not helpful. It's not doing me any good or anybody else any good. So we have to learn about it and then gain a value system that wants to deal with it. So let's try this a little bit. Let me see what time it is. Oh, good, okay. So we have 20 minutes or so. Yeah. So invoking that you let your body relax, invoking that inner friend, and the inner friend is that one who of course you know because you've been this way to your friends and plants and animals and to yourself also. That part of you that is really gentle and caring. The love and care that you know how to give to others, we want to include ourselves in that and be a recipient of that also. So invoking what I call the inner friend. Just direct that type of warmth and care to your body. Spending a moment just appreciating your body and your sense organs and your brain, breath. How amazing to have a body. And invoke that love and appreciation also to your mind. It takes care of so many things. Your buddhi and just your general mind, the manas. Turn your attention inward to the little ones inside. What do I mean by little ones? Well, so many experiences that a child has that have been very traumatic or hurtful, embarrassing, shameful in one way or another. You can experience this when you're 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. All of those experiences are stored inside because that's how your unconscious, your defense system protected you from feelings you couldn't handle when you were little. So now as an inner friend, as someone who cares, you can now go inside and, in a sense, rescue all those little ones. You can say, is there anyone inside who wants to tell me anything? You, the conscious adult, are now making yourself available to those unconscious parts inside that are used to just projecting themselves out at appropriate situations, but no one ever comes inside to be with them as they are. So has anyone inside had anything to say? And you just see what comes up and be a good listener. You may remember some events that took place when you were little. Let yourself get into a dialogue and be with whatever feelings are there. It can often be a little one. If it's something current, it doesn't matter. You're just going to deal with whatever comes up. But often it is a child's hurt. Exercise like this is you are the one who really knows what happened. You know, you understand, you know why that child is hurt, and you can help. It's like you as the adult are the one who can rescue yourself as a little child. out of what you're doing. You can do this within what you're doing. Say if you're with the little girl or boy that was feeling hurt or telling you all about it, or if that isn't happening, maybe with the memory, you can do this. And the image of that and the affect of that hurt child. Just gently shift your focus to your own being, to your own presence. With a hurt child, that is a gentle shift of focus to your own presence, to your own being. Abiding is your own being, is your own presence. Child into focus. You are your own being. You're bringing that little child into your presence in a sense. Just kind of play back and forth with that if you can. Totally accepting a painful feeling for the little child, being with it, I gently shift my focus to my own presence. how that was for you. There's one thing that I think is really something to work on and practice, because I think it's so effective. And that is, if you get into that relationship with some part, internal pain, you know, then to actually, when you totally welcome that first, and you're just like a good parent, totally with that hurt, whatever it is. And then right in the middle of that, when that's there, you gently shift your focus to your own being. And then the truth of yourself, which is so whole and complete, fills up that hurt part. And that is so healing. You get used to just doing that. Even when you're walking along or going through your day or whatever, you learn how to be with these hurts and whatnot that arise. So instead of trying to solve it out here, which doesn't really usually work, it's best to solve in here first and then solve out here. To go first to the hurt and then deal objectively with what's out here. Because usually when you're really hurting or reacting to something that's negative, something that's hurt as though hurt you and the world, if it's really hurt you that much, it's probably something inside that's been triggered. Otherwise, the hurt that hurts out here, not much. It's that they go into that unconscious hurt that then kind of overwhelms the situation. And so it doesn't really help you to go out here and try to solve a problem that doesn't have its origin out here. So you can go there inside first and then just be with it, be in dialogue with it. And then when it's completely accepted, welcomed, then to just do that gentle change, shift of focus to your own presence. And that just, I don't know what it does, it just, your own presence feels that little hurt. It cures it in a way.
When you do that, it seems like it's easy to go to your own presence. But is that healing the emotional hurt that's there?
It can. If you're totally welcoming and being with that hurt like a good parent to a little child, so that hurt and all that diet or whatever is not being pushed away at all. It's even relatively, it's not being pushed away. Then when you shift the focus to your own being in the middle of that hurt, then your being, the wholeness of your being fills up that hurt in a sense. So it dissipates it. So it's a really beautiful exercise to just play around with, because you'll see as you work with that, you'll see what happens. It's also internal. It's hard to, I'm just using words that should give you something to play with.
So
it's not really effective.
It's not a question of really kind of analyzing where that all the dynamics to the hurt. It's better to welcome it.
And let it tell you, like a little children inside will talk to you. Like if you say, what is really hurting you? What's bothering you? It'll tell you. And then you can be a good listener. But the main thing, whether it's talking or not talking, is that there's no pushing away, that you're allowing that to be with you and to talk to you. And you also, remember when I said, you as the adult are the one who really knows what happened. So you're the most understanding person. You're the best therapist because you were there. You know, but that little child part is kind of locked away in time inside. And so you can really be welcoming of that and understanding it and being the best friend, or, you know, the one friend, philosopher, guide, as Swamiji would sometimes say. Now when I'm just giving you that little extra thing that you can make a little shift right in the middle of that to your own presence, and that as though it becomes the reality of that, it like blows it apart in a way.
So, yeah. So it's not a question of putting a magnifying glass on the hurt and seeing, you know, all the steps that it causes. It's more welcoming, letting it talk, but also shifting the whole.
instead of you trying to analyze what happened, it's letting that little one talk about what happened. That's quite a bit different. When you're letting the little one tell you what happened, then that's the part, that's the actual experience. You as an adult can go in and analyze. That's not always that useful. Maybe, but what's useful is that little one, Essa, has a friend who it can talk to all about it, tell you everything. You know, and then in that welcoming, there's a lot of cure in that. Just like in therapy, if the client goes to the therapist and there's that trust there, there's something very curative about just being able to say what it is to somebody who gives you the benefit of the doubt, who's on your side, you know, who thinks you're a good person, you know, and just being able to bring all of that out in to be witnessed is very curative. But we're going just a little bit, we're adding a little something there, and that is that little shift of focus, because we all have self-knowledge, you know. So the Vedanta, you can bring your own presence, just a little shift of focus, and that your presence is so whole and complete, it doesn't, your being doesn't have a problem. It's, your being is not hurt. It doesn't have a complex. It doesn't have any trauma. You know,
it increases the welcoming too. I mean, yeah.
Because the self is by nature completely welcoming. There's nothing rejecting about yourself. The self doesn't, no such thing exists from the standpoint of your being. There's no, nothing that pushes away. There's only welcoming, in fact. You know. Of your being.
Of your being. Once it's out, and once it's fine, once it's whatever it really is.
Yeah.
And then that, it, the pain or the hurt gets sublimated into that greater truth. So it's more that it gets absorbed into that truth as the truth goes.
I think you could look at it in both ways. Like I sometimes use the word that gets diffuse. You know, it just, so it loses it, the tension goes away, and as the tension goes away, it actually goes away. And so you can say that whole thing is just resolving into your being, and as it's resolving into your being comes into the forefront. Even though there's no motion, it's not like your being is going, bum, 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 bum. But in that sublimation, as you call it, I call it when it becomes diffused, then what's really just left there is you. And so from the standpoint of the mind, it's like your being is what is dominant then. You know, and that's so whole and complete. So say a little wounded child is then filled with itself, because it is its self. That self is not hurt. You know? But it has to be accepted first for that. But yeah. If the flip side of the diet... You know, one way to deal with that, I didn't bring that in today, but this is important. In a dyad, what is interjected into the little child, say 4 years old, what is it? Made it two, like mother-child, that's two. So it's a relationship made of two parts, mother-child, you know, father-son. There's a relationship there. That's that relationship, because dyad means two, right? There's a relationship. So when there's some sort of trauma, it usually has to do with has taken place in a relationship. And so what happens is both parts of the relationship are interjected. So sometimes we call it the wounded and the wounder and the wounded, or the, you know, perpetrator and the victim or whatever. So both sides are inside, are swallowed inside. as the bookends of that emotion. So that's the dyad.
Yeah.
So you actually don't just have a little wounded child inside, you have the mean parent or whatever. So sometimes when you're working with the dyad, one or the other can become dominant, like say, like what Laura's saying, the kind of the wounder became more dominant, and so how do you handle that? Well, one really beautiful way to handle that is to remember that it's the four-year-old or the three-year-old who is interjecting that dyad, okay? And so now you have the parental figure that is like a little four-year-old wearing daddy's shoes, mommy's shoes, you know? And then you have the hurt part. And so you can actually talk to the one who is doing the hurting as a little four-year-old and saying, you know, it's okay, you don't have to play that role anymore. Because they take that in, and it's only a four-year-old little buddhi there. You know, so they're playing that role in the hurt. It's like a four-year-old psyche that's got those two. So that when you understand that, then you can be very compassionate to the mean one, because it's just a little four-year-old, you know. And you could say you don't have to play this role anymore. It's okay. I understand that really did happen, and daddy or mommy was mean or whatever it is. You know, but you are not mean.
And then the shift of focus happens. In this process you just described.
Well, I'm saying once this process has been welcomed and you're working with it, at what seems like an appropriate time to you, you can just make these gentle shifts to your own presence, where your presence becomes more dominant in that scene. Why I say that is that your presence, your being, is not only the self of you, the adult, it's the self of the whole dyad. It's the self of the little one, it's the self of the meanie in the dyad. And so when you bring yourself into that slight shift of focus, that's healing for the whole thing. It's just a movement of the truth of both of the being of the whole complex. And that the nature of yourself is so whole and complete that it tends to disrupt that the stress that's causing the pain in the particular complex.
So that's the advantage that Vedantin has over
that's something that with your understanding you can do. It might be in psychology, there might be other ways, like that you just call it the witness or whatever. We're calling it the self because we know what the self is in terms of, you know. But that's actually a very, very healing factor. But I'm using words for something that you actually have to try to really understand.
It seems like it's a good strategy to do this off-grid, so to speak, like when you're not in it, you know, so it kind of... takes the charge out of these situations when they come up. You actually work on them when you're not in them, because when you're in them, it seems like these pain bodies, like Tara describes them as pain bodies.
Who does?
Tara Eckhart.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I think it's brilliant.
Brilliant
description. That's exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Because they're so, the whole, they just grab it.
But I would say is if you're practicing them when you're like away from them, right? That's you build up a skill and a capacity.
Yeah.
And then that skill and capacity becomes available to you moment to moment. Initially, you have to really build it up, and it becomes just a tool. It becomes natural. And then you can use it in the moment because you have a value for it, and you have the skill, and you know what it is. And so, pew, you can do that.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to say. That's really helpful.
Yeah.
To to do that when you're not even you're actually building a resource there.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. You're building that capacity and resource that then's just then naturally available to you because you know, you're used to it. And also your value system changes. As in light of your knowledge, your value system changes. Like I would rather just be with Ishvara. You know, be with myself, the wholeness of myself, and then experience my prarabdha karma, the karma that you're enjoying right now, and just do your best. This is it. You know, and you spend less and less time in Jiva Srishti because I would rather be with you than in my imaginal world. I prefer to be here, you know. And more I think you prefer to be here because it's so uncluttered. You know, it's simple. Life is simple when you're in the present. We make it very complex and worrisome when we're living so much in Jiva Srishti, you know. Because we are it's so easy to get into catastrophic thinking because we can. In your imagination, you see the whole, the good and the bad to almost limitlessly. Anything, this great thing can happen, but this can also happen, you know. And so you're generating a whole world of emotions that have nothing to do with reality, really.
Yeah, when you get into that catastrophic thinking, there's fear involved.
There's fear, yeah. Fear is generated.
Yeah, so, and that fear is kind of amorphous. You don't really, it doesn't have any clear definition. It's just...
No, but then you learn how, like say there's some fear there. You can say, because you know how to do this, you can say, okay, this I'm really afraid. What's that really about? You can talk to it. What are you really afraid of? You can ask, and it'll tell you. And then you might have something to say, you know. You might have the capacity to say, let's not worry about that now. Let's be here. So let's see what happens. Let's see what Ishvara does. And then deal with life as it actually happens. It makes things so much easier.
Because you don't think that Ishvara will take something from you.
There is some complexes around your relationship with Ishvara. Then that has to be worked on. Yeah, because...
But the fear was born out of something going wrong, taking away from you, losing something.
Yeah.
Some damage.
Yeah.
Is that part of Ishvara as well?
Well, we have to... Everything's part of Ishvara.
Okay.
Yeah. You can't say to Ishvara, you know, if you're there and you want me to like you,
yeah,
you have to be, you know,
kind to me.
And that's why it kind of helps to realize that this particular loka, it's 50-50. You know, because of your karma.
Yeah, I thought that today.
Yeah.
I was getting the dark side of the 50.
Yeah. Like when Swamiji really suffered this last few years of his life, not mentally, really, but physically, he really suffered, you know. You know, it was a lot. And he never complained, and he felt really... Like, you know, we get what we deserve. And that's a negative way of saying it in English, but he wasn't saying it in that negative way. It's like, this is part of my life. This is part of my karma, and I accept that, you know?
I accept that.
That's pretty itching. I accept the whole thing, but darn itching, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, you know, in Sanskrit, you know, when we say it has the sense of experience, the anubhava, you know, and when we use it, and so because Swamiji uses it that way, I'm so used to thinking of it that way. When we say enjoy, that's something positive.
Yeah.
But enjoy has to be has the sense in Sanskrit of whatever experience is there, that experience I'm having. So you're right. Enjoy is not a good word in English to use. Because in Sanskrit, but that's why, because it's handling both sides. Means any experience. I could have, instead of saying that he enjoys that, he experience, has that experience. It's his experience.
Use the word experience, it sounds like outside.
Yeah.
Or say exit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true.
So
yeah.
I think
But the thing is, it's true that when we use the word enjoy, we should. It's another word, whether it's English or Sanskrit, you have to say. I should say, like, we use this word enjoy because blah, 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 so that then it's allowed, that word is allowed to be used in reference to both positive and negative experiences.
Because to enjoy sadness or to enjoy fear.
That's right, because that means that that experience is there.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, you don't have to stop using any word, because every word's problematic, really. So, but they have to be defined. That's a whole teaching tradition, really. Every word, whether it's Sanskrit or English, you have to define, and sometimes the teacher misses it. So that, but the student always gets her back in line. Or him. No, because, oh, that could be taken this way, and then you remember, and then you have to unpack that word. It's all part of the teaching, because you can't take communication for granted when we're talking about something that is really not a sense object. It's the nature of the subject. You know, and so all of these words have to be used, and even when we're talking about consciousness or limitless or existence, these don't mean anything. They mean only something within relative reality. So all of the words have to be in, some just say, and we have to unpack them.
So if you feel Ishwaras takes this unfairly takes away something from you, there's a problem there, right?
Yeah, there is a problem there that we have to work on.
But it shouldn't be seen in that form or that.
What do you mean?
That you've been abused or taken or something's been.
There's just a different context to take that away. Take that, even though this was taken from you, you know. Then, but what is the? How do you hold that? Was he being mean to you? See, he took something away from me. He punished me. He's being mean to you. It's like like you're being spanked for, and you didn't do anything. You know. So we have to get more depth around that whole, all of the karmas that are involved, and with the whole way of a different way of looking at that, because otherwise it's really anthropomorphizing God. If you could look down on everybody and you're all really innocent, and then for no reason he just picks it on you and attacks you and does all this terrible stuff to you for no reason at all. He's just some sort of a monster. Why should I have any shraddha in him? This monster God that comes in, you know. So we have to put all of these type of these are all kind of childhood images, and that we have to bring all of those to consciousness, and then we have to look at it differently.
But it's not only an image, you can also kind of, if you're an innocent child and you get some kind of big time trauma.
The whole thing has to be dealt with the little child inside.
What is the resolution that Jungian psychology offers to the situation? You know, I mean, I don't need you to go into detail, but where's the resolution? Because like what you just shared with us seems to be like a Vedantic resolution. In a nutshell, I know. I mean, there's ways to elaborate on everything, but. Mm-hmm. What's the union? Where do they? Is there an actual resolution of these, like what you said, 3 to 10 experiences, core wounding experiences that everybody carries within them? is do they actually do therapy? Look at it as a, into what is it resolved into? You know what I mean? Here we are resolving it into Ishvara.
Well, I don't think it resolves in exactly the same way, but when you, we find just within psychology, not Vedanta, when, and but Vedanta also, because Vedanta takes all of this. When you are able to come into relationship with some painful event or childhood event, you come into relationship just like when we're doing this inner child work. That itself is very healing. That resolves the pain of the child as it comes into consciousness and is accepted. So that's a very healing. Now there's another thing that we call the transcendent function, where there's a terrible conflict that you're suffering from, and you can't, if you do this, it was kind of like Arjuna's problem. If he did this, he would be miserable. If he did this, he'll be miserable. There's no way out. And so what Jung discovered, and I think all of us discover in our own way if we're in this situation, if you hold this conflict that has no resolution for you, this way you're screwed, this way you're screwed, there's no way out. So if you can hold it without making a judgment on it, but just be with it, you will actually transcend that problem and then solve it on a totally different level. And that's what Jung calls the transcendent function. And the example he uses for it is, imagine a great big mountain, and halfway up there's a heavy bank of clouds, and there's a rainstorm, dark clouds and a rainstorm and thunderstorm pouring down onto the rest, on the mountain below, and then onto the valley. But say now you climb up that mountain, and you climb above the clouds, right? Then that rainstorm is still there, all of the problems, all the floods, everything's going on. But you're now at a totally different vantage point that is not being subject to the rainstorm. That's called the transcendent function. So now you're viewing the whole situation from a different vantage point. So what he says is, if you can, whatever the issue is that's not solved, the unsolvable issue, whatever that is, if you can just hold on and just be with it and be patient, then see, the psyche will come up with a solution that takes place on a different level, because on that particular level, there is no solution. Either way is going to be bad. And so I love that. That's how I use that, is that a lot of times we always want an answer to the problem, whatever it is. Like, what am I going to do? You know, we want an answer right away before that answer is available to us, really. It's not there. That answer's not there, and yet we're pushing for it. So those are the times to be patient and just hold that situation and just see what Bhagavan does. Just be patient, and it will solve itself. But we can always see into the future, you know, so we want a solution. We know this is going to have to be solved in one way or another. We have no idea how that's going to happen, and so then we have all this angst and whatnot about it. But what you can do is just say, okay, we'll see what happens. And then be patient and watch your psyche and the whole situation come to a resolve in time. That's a wonderful understanding to practice. It's enjoyable, actually, because then otherwise you think that you're supposed to come up with a solution, and when am I going to come up with a solution? You're not going to come up with a solution until the solution is given to you. It has to be given to you, and things have to fall into place to make that to reveal that solution, whatever it is. So that patience is a really wonderful thing to have in terms of this, what he calls the transcendent function. In any Jungian book, you probably look it up and Google it or something, and you'll see a lot of writings up here. I love that, though. The transcendent function is very powerful.
Can you translate that to Vedanta in what respect?
I always think, well, just how I'm saying, it's like you don't always have a solution. You know that you're going to have to do something. You have no idea what to do. And you can look, well, that's because that solution isn't there yet. And so you can learn how to be patient. It's patience.
Because you say that it's on one level, it always comes down to a problem of gratification, that you want something that you're not getting. And it might just be a solution, or it might be that one side or the other. That's always present.
Yes, the
might oversimplify, but...
The raga dvesha, your likes and dislikes. Remember when we say raga dvesha, we're not meaning preference, right? Raga dvesha means I need this to be like this in order for me to be happier. I can't have that happen if I'm going to be happy. So my well-being's at stake with raga dvesha. And the raga dvesha, these likes and dislikes, take place on many different levels. Some are just very, very subtle, hardly noticeable at all, but they're there. Yeah. And so... when you realize that and that, then you can gain what I call vairagya. As you become more conscious of your raga dveshas, then you can kind of give them over to Bhagavan. You bring your knowledge in, because actually your likes and dislikes are illusory in the sense that the ananda you're seeking you already have. That's the truth of it. What you're seeking, you already have. It's already your being. And so we're getting ourselves all worked up over something that's absolutely fallacious, actually. And so all of them end up getting reduced to preferences, because just as jivas, with all of our experiences, we've had positive and negative experiences and things that culturally we prefer this. Like Swamiji will use the example, South Indians prefer idlis and North Indians prefer chapatis. But it's preference. It's not going to get you all upset if you get chapatis when you want idlis. You know, it's preference. So your likes and dislikes get reduced to preference because... your well-being is not at stake, you know. So when your well-being's at stake, then that's raga dvesha. And if you notice you're getting kind of at stake, then that's a good time to kind of bring in your knowledge and get your sanity back.
Being right there, you know? On the spot. I mean, right.
If you're able to do that, if you can't do it on the spot because it's not available to you, then you do it later. But as your mind calms down, you can more or less just do it on the spot. You have to give your mind a chance to unwind over a few years. It has to unwind in the light of your knowledge. It takes some time. It's pleasurable to watch it grow, though, to mature in the, you know, with your knowledge. Because it's so pleasurable. It's very pleasurable to just be here and... be part of Bhagavan's creation and see what role you're playing in it now, and do your dharma in this, and that's it. It's an easy thing, you know. The raga dvesha create a lot of stress.
It's interesting that you talk about diffusion as like the antidote to that.
You know what?
Raga dvesha does involve kind of a tightening and sharpening.
What I use that word diffuse for something to become diffuse. To me, it's the opposite of stress. Stress is like this, you know, constriction. And then when you relax, it becomes diffuse. And when it becomes diffuse, what is left is the clay of the pot, you know, the pot. Like when you relax your body, the more you relax your body, it as though disappears, because the edges are so relaxed, you don't even notice it. And in that relaxation, your being is what's predominant, because the body's not calling any attention to itself. It's not that it's not there, it's just not calling any attention. It's like the pot of the clay pot. The pot is not calling any attention to itself, so it's just the clay is there. Even though the clay is always there, and the only thing that's there, the pot is so relaxed that only the clay seems to be dominant in the situation, if that analogy works.
Yeah.
Should we call it a night now? Yeah.